the first canto, fourth chapter. This is Defense of Narada Muni. Yatu vacha iti bhuvanam samsuya uninam dirga satrinam vidakula pati sutam pavricha shonako bravit. On hearing Sutta Goswami speak, Shonaka Muni, who was the elderly, learned scholar of all the rishis, engaged in that prolonged sacrificial ceremony, congratulated Sutta Goswami by addressing him as follows. In a meeting of learned men, when there are congratulations or addresses for the speaker, the qualifications of the congratulator should be as follows. He must be the leader of the house and an elderly man. He must be vastly learned also. Sri Shonaka Rishi had all these qualifications, and thus he stood up to congratulate Sri Sutta Goswami when he expressed his desire to present Srimad Bhagavatam exactly as he heard it from Shukadev Goswami, and also realized it personally. Personal realization does not mean that one should, out of vanity, attempt to show one's own learning by trying to surpass the previous acharya. He must have full confidence in the previous acharya, and at the same time, he must realize the subject matter so nicely that he can present the matter for the particular circumstance in a suitable manner. The original purpose of the text must be maintained. No obscure meaning should be screwed out of it. Yet it should be presented in an interesting manner for the understanding of the audience. This is called realization. The leader of the assembly, Shonaka, could estimate the value of the speaker, Sri Sutta Goswami, simply by his uttering yataditam and yata mati, and therefore he was very glad to congratulate him in ecstasy. No learned man should be willing to hear a person who does not represent the original acharya. So the speaker and the audience were bona fide in this meeting where Bhagavatam was being recited for the second time. That should be the standard of recitation of Bhagavatam, so that the real purpose can be served without difficulty. Unless this situation is created, Bhagavatam recitation for extraneous purposes is useless labor both for the speaker and for the audience. Shonaka uvacha sutta sutta mahabhaga varana varatam vara Katam Bhagavatim Punyam Yadaha Bhagavan Chuka. Shonaka said, O Sutta Goswami, you are the most fortunate and respected of all those who can speak and recite. Please relate the pious message of Srimad Bhagavatam which was spoken by the great and powerful sage Shukadeva Goswami. Report. Sutta Goswami is twice addressed herein by Shonaka Goswami out of great joy because he and the members of the assembly were eager to hear the text of Bhagavatam uttered by Shukadev Goswami. They were not interested in hearing it from a bogus person who would interpret in his own way to suit his own purpose. Generally, the so-called Bhagavatam reciters are either professional readers or so-called learned impersonalists who cannot enter into the transcendental personal activities of the Supreme Person. Such impersonalists twist some meaning out of the Bhagavatam to suit and support impersonalist views, and the professional readers at once go to the 10th canto to misexplain the most confidential part of the Lord's pastimes. Neither of these reciters are bona fide persons to recite Bhagavatam. Only one who is prepared to present Bhagavatam in the light of Shukadev Goswami, and those who are prepared to hear Shukadev Goswami and his representative are bona fide participants in the transcendental discussion of Srimad Bhagavatam. Kasmin yuge pravritteyam staneva kena hetuna kuta sanchorita krishna kritavam samhitam muni. In what period and at what place was this first begun, and why was this taken up? From where did Krishna Dvapayana Vyas, the great sage, get the inspiration to compile this literature? Because Srimad Bhagavatam is the special contribution of Srila Vyasadeva, there are so many inquiries by the learned Shonaka Muni. It was known to them that Srila Vyasadeva had already explained the text of the Vedas in various ways up to the Mahabharata for the understanding of the less intelligent women, Shudras, and fallen members of the family of the twice-born men. Srimad Bhagavatam is transcendental to all of them because it has nothing to do with anything mundane. So the inquiries are very intelligent and relevant.
Tasya putra mahayogi samadrin nirvikalpaka ekanta mahir unidro buddha muddha iveyate.
He, Vyasadeva's son, was a great devotee, an equal-balanced monist whose mind was always concentrated in monism. He was transcendental to mundane activities, but being unexposed, he appeared like an ignorant person. Srila Shukadeva Goswami was a liberated soul, and thus he remained always alert not to be trapped by the illusory energy. In the Bhagavad Gita, this alertness is very lucidly explained. The liberated soul and the conditioned soul have different engagements. The liberated soul is always engaged in the progressive path of spiritual attainment, which is something like a dream for the conditioned soul. The conditioned soul cannot imagine the actual engagements of the liberated soul. While the conditioned soul thus dreams about spiritual engagements, the liberated soul is awake. Similarly, the engagement of a conditioned soul appears to be a dream for the liberated soul. A conditioned soul and a liberated soul may apparently be on the same platform, but factually they are differently engaged, and their attention is always alert, either in sense enjoyment or in self-realization. The conditioned soul is absorbed in matter, whereas the liberated soul is completely indifferent to matter. This indifference is explained as follows.
Vishwanayam tam rishimat majam apinangam devya huya parababur nasutas suchitam padviksha pichcha mono jagatas tavasti sri pumbirana tu sutasya vivik padrishta.
Well, Sri Vyasadeva was following his son. Beautiful young damsels who were bathing naked covered their bodies with cloth, although Sri Vyasadeva himself was not naked. But they had not done so when his son had passed. The sage inquired about this, and the young ladies replied that his son was purified, and when looking at them made no distinction between male and female. But the sage made such distinctions. Purport. In the Bhagavad Gita 5.18, it is said that a learned sage looks equally, and a learned and gentle Brahmin, a chandala, dog-eater, a dog, or a cow, due to his spiritual vision. Srila Shukadeva Goswami attained that stage. Thus he did not see male or female. He saw all living entities in different dress. The ladies who were bathing could understand the mind of a man simply by studying his demeanor, just as by looking at a child one can understand how innocent he is. Shukadeva Goswami was a young boy, 16 years old, and therefore all the parts of his body were developed. He was naked also, and so were the ladies. But because Shukadeva Goswami was transcendental to sex relations, he appeared very innocent. The ladies, by their special qualification, could sense this at once, and therefore they were not very concerned about him. But when his father passed, the ladies quickly dressed. The ladies were exactly like his children or grandchildren, but they reacted to the presence of Vyasadeva according to the social custom, because Srila Vyasadeva played the part of a householder. A householder has to distinguish between a male and a female, otherwise he cannot be a householder. One should therefore attempt to know the distinction between spirit soul without any attachment for male and female.
Katham alakshita porae samprapta kuru jangalan ummata mukha jadavat picharan gajista yavaye saha vaye.
How was he, Srila Sukadeva Goswami, the son of Vyas, recognized by the citizens when he entered the city of Hastinapur, now Delhi, after wandering in the provinces of Kuru Jungala and Jungala, appearing like a madman, dumb and retarded? Report. The present city of Delhi was formerly known as Hastinapur because it was first established by King Hasti. Goswami Sukadeva, after leaving his paternal home, was roaming like a madman, and therefore it was very difficult for the citizens to recognize him in his exalted position. The sage is not therefore recognized by sight, but by hearing. One should approach a sadhu or a great sage not to see, but to hear him. If one is not prepared to hear the words of a sadhu, there is no profit. Shukadeva Goswami was a sadhu who could speak on the transcendental activities of the Lord. He did not satisfy the whims of ordinary citizens. He was recognized when he spoke on the subject of Bhagavatam, and he never attempted jugglery like a magician. Outwardly, he appeared to be a retarded, dumb madman, but in fact, he was the most elevated transcendental personality. Katamva Pandaveyasya Rajesha Munina Saha Samvada Samabhutata Yatraisha Satvati Shuti. How did it happen that King Parikshit met this great sage, making it possible for this great transcendental essence of the Vedas, Bhagavatam, to be sung to him? Purport. Srimad Bhagavatam is stated here as the essence of the Vedas. It is not an imaginary story, as it is sometimes considered by unauthorized men. It is also called the Shuka Samhita, or the Vedic hymn spoken by Sri Shukadeva Goswami, the great liberated sage. Sagodohana matram hi griheshu griha medhinam avekshate mahabhagas tirtikorvam stadashramam. He, Shukadeva Goswami, was accustomed to stay at the door of a householder only long enough for a cow to be milked, and he did this just to sanctify the residence. Shukadeva Goswami met Emperor Parikshit and explained the text of Srimad Bhagavatam. He was not accustomed to stay at any householder's residence for more than half an hour at the time of the milking of the cow, and he would just take alms from the fortunate householder. That was to sanctify the residence by his auspicious presence. Therefore, Shukadeva Goswami is an ideal preacher established in the transcendental position. From his activities, those who are in the renounced order of life and dedicated to the mission of preaching the message of Godhead should learn that they have no business with householders save and except to enlighten them in transcendental knowledge. Such asking for alms from the householder should be for the purpose of sanctifying his home. One who is in the renounced order of life should not be allured by the glamour of the householder's worldly possessions and thus become subservient to worldly men. For one who is in the renounced order of life, this is much more dangerous than drinking poison and committing suicide. Avimanyu sutam suta prahur bhagavato tamam tasya janna mahascharyam karmani chagrini hina. It is said that Maharaj Parikshit is a great first-class devotee of the Lord, and that his birth and activities are all wonderful. Please tell us about him. Purport. The birth of Maharaj Parikshit is wonderful because in the womb of his mother he was protected by the personality of Godhead Sri Krishna. His activities are also wonderful because he chastised Kali, who was attempting to kill a cow. To kill cows means to end human civilization. He wanted to protect the cow from being killed by the great representative of sin. His death is also wonderful because he got previous notice of his death, which is wonderful for any mortal being, and thus he prepared himself for passing away by sitting down on the bank of the Ganges and hearing the transcendental activities of the Lord. During all the days he heard the transcendental activities of the Lord. He heard Srimad Bhagavatam. He did not take food or drink, nor did he sleep a moment. So everything about him is wonderful, and his activities are worth hearing attentively. Desire is expressed herein to hear about him in detail. Sa samrat kasya vaheto pandunam manavardhana praya padishto gangayam anadritya dirachriyam. He was a great emperor and possessed all the opulences of his acquired kingdom. He was so exalted that he was increasing the prestige of the Pandu dynasty. Why did he give up everything to sit down on the bank of the Ganges and fast until death? Purport. Maharaj Parikshit was the emperor of the world and all the seas and oceans, and he did not have to take the trouble to acquire such a kingdom by his own effort. He inherited it from his grandfathers, Maharaj Yudhisthira, and brothers. Besides that, he was doing well in the administration and was worthy of the good names of his forefathers. Consequently, there was nothing undesirable in his opulence and administration. Why should he give up all these valuable circumstances and sit down on the bank of the Ganges, fasting till death? This is astonishing, and therefore all were eager to know the cause. I'll read one more. Namanti yadparaniketamatmana shivayahanniyadanana shatrava katam saviva shriyamanga dushta Jajam Yavaiso Tastotram Aho Sahoshubi. He was a great emperor, so great that all his enemies would come and bow down at his feet and surrender all their wealth for his own benefit. He was full of youth and strength, and he possessed insuperable kingly opulences. Why did he want to give everything up, including his life? Purport.
There was nothing undesirable in his life. He was quite a young man and could enjoy life with power and opulence. So there was no question of retiring from active life. There was no difficulty in collecting the state taxes, because he was so powerful and chivalrous that even his enemies would come to him and bow down at his feet and surrender all wealth for their own benefit. Maharaj Parikshit was a pious king. He conquered his enemies, and therefore the kingdom was full of prosperity. There was enough milk, grains, and metals, and all the rivers and mountains were full of potency. So materially everything was satisfactory. Therefore there was no question of untimely giving up his kingdom and life. The sages were eager to hear about all this.
Do you want something to
go
on your bank?
Right?
Oh,
that's all right. Okay. Any discussion on this?
If you
worry.
If you wouldn't mind, was the at that time, even at the end of Dwapara Yuga, which that must have been, I presume, there was still a reasonable amount of opulence around at that time. Is it almost that when the so-called season sort of changed, that it's quite a dramatic thing? Like as soon as it actually astrologically happens, then everything happens, or is it a gradual?
It's a gradual process. But there are certain omens and symptoms that occurred at the time of Kali Yuga that made it known. And the most astonishing, or the most dramatic thing, was when the king saw that Kali had come personified version of Kali in the form of a very black colored person who was attacking a cow. That incident is considered to be the symbol that Kali had actually arrived. And that the legs of the cow were crippled except for the one leg, which represents truthfulness. So that was symbolic at the age of Kali. There were also inauspicious symptoms, because at that time Krishna had left the planet. There were jackals braying at the moon and so on. There were sometimes the blood was coming from the sky. But that was a temporary phenomenon that made it clear that this was now Kali Yuga. It was symbolized by Krishna's coming. Of course, Krishna doesn't come at the beginning of every Kali Yuga. This is a particular millennium when the Dwapara Yuga and the Treta Yuga were reversed. Ordinarily, the Dwapara Yuga comes first in the Treta Yuga. Yeah, that's
also... when he takes his appearance, then?
Yeah, that's explained. I think that's in the 28th millennium. It's explained in the Bhagavatam. Mm. But it is a gradual thing. Prabhupada was saying that in Vrindavan, even as recently as 40 or 50 years ago, in Vrindavan in India, the climate was much more suitable. It was very warm even in the evening, whereas now it's quite cold. And the rain only came in the evenings. And then he speaks about how the price of grains has gone since he remembers his childhood. It was so many, something less than a pice per anna, which is less than a kilo, a very tiny measurement. And that's a very large measurement for a very small amount. I forget what an ani is. But anyway, the idea is that you can see there's a gradual deterioration. Although sometimes it accelerates, and then it slows down. But basically it's a gradual thing, just like the lifespan. It starts out at the beginning of Kali, you get 100 years, and it gradually dwindles down to the end to about 15 or 16 years. It's all a very gradual process. And gradually there's more scarcity of water. At the end of the Kali Yuga, it's almost impossible to find water either for bathing or drinking. And the weather becomes more and more, gradually it becomes more inclement, more intemperate. It becomes very hot. The fruits gradually become smaller. The seeds get bigger in all the fruits. There's shortage of all these things, and in the end of the Kali Yuga, it's described in the 12th canon, people are just eating grass. So it's just a step by step. everything diminishes. Justice becomes less and less possible, more possible by how much money you have. You've probably read about some of those symptoms there in the 12th canon. And we can see that it's a gradual thing. Although, of course, there's a 10,000-year period where Krishna consciousness becomes very prominent. Prabhupada explains that's like the summer coming in the middle of winter. I remember it was here once, and there was a very warm spell in January, and all the cherry blossoms started coming out, and many different other trees blossomed. And then when spring came, of course, it didn't come out very well. But I remember it was about 5 or 6 days. I think this was in 1973, if I'm not mistaken. For about 5 or 6 days, temperatures were going into the high 70s and low 80s. So it's something like that. Very anomalous situation, anachronistic. But basically, it's a gradual thing. Also, people gradually leave the cities and live like hermits away from civilization because the taxes become increased and it's harder for them to survive. Mm. Of course, there's also devastation at the end of Kali Yuga. That's a dramatic
thing. That would be a partial
one. Yeah, partial devastation. And then when such a yuga sets in, that starts out with a very long lifespan of 100,000 years.
Well, cells from other planets at that point, or heavenly planets, come down for that Satyuga, because it seems to me that most of the people who will be around about that time will be pretty kind of low consciousness. Will they get elevated up into Satyuga again, or will they just pass off into some lower form of life?
And those in Satyuga?
Yeah, for instance, I'm here at the end of Kali Yuga, you know, 18 inches high, demoniac, mm-hmm. whatever else. I won't be able to take part in Satyuga, would I?
It's possible. I mean, it all depends on Krishna. Mm-hmm. Although the people coming at the end of Kali Yuga are very degraded, so they're just like animals. They live, they eat flesh, eat their own offspring. And, of course, Kalki comes at the end and kills every human on the planet, so they're getting some special mercy. They may get elevated to Vaikuntha because they
even saw Kalki.
Yeah, they were actually seeing Kalki, and anyone who Krishna directly kills is elevated to Vaikuntha, although as an impersonalist. So they have that opportunity right at the very end of Kali Yuga. But the human beings are degraded to a very low position at that state, and they are very sinful, so they're not likely to get a high birth unless there's some special mercy. Have to go through they're in a cycle of punishment which they'll probably have to continue on a lot further before they'll burn out all their karma. But at every point that karma is burned out, they have a chance to come back and become elevated again once it's all expended.
Mm. It's just an inconceivable thing, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I think we've probably done this lots of times.
Yeah. So when we look at a child, or we think, oh, it's just a little new entity, but actually it's been an old man, it's been through millions of lifetimes, suffered all sorts of things, and yet it looks so innocent and simple. It's a hard thing to understand. I was giving a talk in San Diego last weekend, and it was just kind of a question and answer type class, and there was a boy about 12, and we went through this analytical study of the body, and he could understand that I'm not my hand, I'm not my head, I'm not my leg, and therefore I couldn't be all the parts of the body, I couldn't be the body. So we talked for about half an hour, and then at the end I asked him, what are you? He said, I'm my body. So I could see it's so hard. You can understand it for a little while, someone can understand it, but actually we identify so much with it that it's even though temporarily someone like that, I don't think he'd ever thought about it before. He could understand it, but actually, it's almost impossible for someone who doesn't really practice it then to actually realize that.
I noted that Michelangelo, Leonardo, and Raphael were unsurpassed in their religious art history. In fact, after they left the planet, no one could follow what they did in terms of classical the religious hour.
Mm-hmm.
And that all appeared around us at the time of of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu.
Yeah.
Is that significant?
Yeah, it's significant in the sense that one was a material renaissance and one was a spiritual renaissance. Because it was just at a time when they were, well, I don't know if they specifically, Michelangelo was somewhat pious, I suppose. And Raphael, I guess. Who else did you say?
Leonardo.
Oh, yeah, Leonardo.
Mm.
Well, Leonardo more, I think. I think Michelangelo was a bit more of that, moving away. There was a definite historical trend away from God, because this idea of the Renaissance was that man was being reborn more in his own merit, and the presence of God in art began to diminish. The whole idea of realism, the way Michelangelo painted God in a very very muscular and human-like way, was a break from the traditional or transcendental type of Christian art, which was more two-dimensional. So the whole trend, you could see it in art and you could see it in everything else, was moving away towards so-called realism, more away from transcendentalism, and God became less of a factor in life. So as the West moved in that direction, there was this renaissance of spiritual life in India with Lord Chaitanya, who was bringing spiritual life back into existence. So, and then we've had to wait 500 years, so that's come to the West.
Oh, interesting. I always thought that because there was painting like the Sistine Chapel and so many other things like that, the religious nature, that actually it was a move toward it, but I see now that it's possibly actually a move away from it.
Yeah, that was kind of a remnant of past Christian history, that at least they were painting, depicting God in heaven and higher things.
Mm.
But the way in which they were depicted were more and more human-like. And the age became increasingly secular at that time. This the whole trend was to become more human. And God became gradually relegated to a position of being uninvolved in life and being when Newton came along and gradually industrial revolution, God became relegated to a guarantor of material laws rather than someone who directly either intervenes or takes part or interacts with our prayer response. And then ultimately now, with quantum theory and quantum mechanics, the idea of God has been practically eliminated, and what was once God, at least an entity who was the guarantor of these laws, has now become just an energy or a force without the name or appellation of God or a supreme being. It's just an energy which is supreme. So now most philosophers and scientists don't want to accept the idea of God. They'll say, well, my idea of God is energy and force. Or some will say goodness or learning or knowledge. But the idea that there can be something called God, even as an impersonal God, is practically now among many philosophical people not acceptable.
So many of the New Age people, they're almost more atheistic than...
Yeah.
In terms of a personal God than anyone now.
Right.
You know, and you'd think that they were closer, but when you take under the closer scrutiny, you see that, you know, they don't like the idea of it.
Yeah, it's something that that scientists too, many progressive scientists who are experimenting in the most esoteric and so-called forward-seeking advances in science, they're also very much that way. They have a kind of sense of an energy, a pervasive energy, but they don't like to think of it as being God. And they're part of the kind of New Age scene a little bit. They're the same. This is considered a very progressive thought now. We're finding new frontiers in between the atoms and molecules of nothingness. And so in that way, people tend to identify us as being sometimes with a New Age or a kind of radical movement or a what we call it, left wing, something like that. But actually our ideas are much more traditional. We're more philosophically, we're more conservative than people realize we are, because we believe in God, God the person, and that we believe in the authority of God, and that there's an order in the universe that comes from God. And therefore we accept authority and things like that, which the New Age movement isn't very interested
in. Right.
instruction, authority, discipline, succession, all that sort of thing.
And yet, if they took the time, to sort of study Srimad Bhagavatam and some of the other scriptures, you know, the things that they're looking for, mysticism, you know, is this big trick for them.
Mm-hmm.
If they were to look, take their time and study, and you know, and get past what their feelings against us, like, or I'm not sure whether they seem to be, you know, whatever, they would find there's more really far out wonderful mysticism in this than in any other thing they're doing. You know, the other night I was talking to this girl, and she said, well, you know, this universe and stuff like that, and I said about Mahavishnu and the expansions, you know, Garbha Daksha, Ashi Daksha, and she was just going, wow, this is incredible, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know, you're studying this Kabbalah and you're doing this Isis unveiled and all these other things. I said, here is more and more and more stuff than you could ever drag up from all the mystery bookshops in the world, you know. It's all here, all contained.
Mm-hmm.
And she was really amazed that she thought we were just some sort of, kind of, we'd take a little bit of something from the East and we kind of made it to some fanatical personal cult, and that was it. Finished.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't get much more behind it than that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's nothing more mystical than Krishna consciousness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you a question. How can we improve our image in that way? How can we make people more aware that there is something more than, you know, the Krishna consciousness is very deep. In other words, how can
we as a collectively, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, Prabhupada, of course, gave us all that. I mean, the idea of being out where people are chanting, distributing books, using the media, create more devotees, and really it's just a matter of, ultimately, it's giving people more association, isn't it? I mean, just being out to more people, and as soon as they hear, they get an idea, they know what it really is. To make an impression on society. I mean, I remember we had the Hare Krishna Mantra record out, and you'd think, well, now everyone, you know, Hare Krishna Mantra, Top of the Pops, 3 times, 4 times. People were chanting, but they didn't know who we were when we went on the street. We talked to them, they didn't have a clue, they didn't have the slightest idea. They thought we were just a pop group. They really didn't know. So it's very hard, even when you have the mass media, something like that, and you're very popular, to really inculcate the idea of Krishna consciousness. And just, you can see it just takes a certain amount of time and a certain number of devotees to talk to a certain number of people before you've actually gotten through, you know, some of your basic philosophy. In Australia, there's 400 devotees and 12 million people, and they've made a lot of penetration there. Probably more than any place. And you can see that it's just due to the larger number of devotees in a smaller population, more intense association. People have a little more sense. They still don't know philosophically a lot, but they still have more of a sense of what Krishna consciousness is. They know it's not just another religion. They see it more as a movement, and they know about the vegetarians, and they just have a little clearer idea. They know it's a happy, kind of a joyful thing that's good for the quality of life. Even that much is
advancement.
It's great advancement, because in this country, in most bigger countries, people don't understand that. Even in Italy, where people are very pious, they don't really know what it's about. They like us because we're religious, and they like all people that wear robes and everything that looks part of a church or a priestly order. They still don't really know what really the difference is. They know we're vegetarians, a lot of them, but just a matter of time and association. It seems that it takes time for any ideology to penetrate. Of course, we have the advantage of chanting on the street, because we're expressing a joyful nature. The more we're out chanting, the more they get a sense of that part of it, and the idea of it. So that's why Prabhupada emphasized that, the idea that it's a joyful, peaceful experience.
What's your feeling about almost full circle situation that America seems to have passed through over the last 20 years? At this time, they're kind of perhaps at the lowest point in the circle, it seems that's the kind of feeling we get from hearing feedback from the stage, you know, with some of the problems they've had out there. Do you feel that, because America is a very important place,
mm-hmm.
and yet we hear that the devotees are not doing so well at this time, but what do you feel for that? Would it be speculation to say what you think?
About the movement in America?
Yes.
Well, I guess it was 1978, it was right after Prabhupada left. Of course, I think we can say that right after the time Prabhupada left, things were progressing very positively and growing almost geometrically in all areas. Not all areas. There were some areas that didn't go, like the spiritual sky business collapsed and a few other things that were going well collapsed. And, you know, it wasn't just a straight, perfect progression. That created some difficulty. But basically, I think you could say things progressed. After Prabhupada left, there was a change from book distribution to doing more and more records, more and more collecting with stickers. So the book distribution began to slump. It peaked out around, I guess, 75 to 78. It was at its peak, and then it began to go down. And one of the reasons was, of course, Prabhupada had left, and it was easier for people to go off the mark. So they started to collect without books, with records and various other paraphernalia. So gradually, the book distribution went down. This wasn't in all parts of America, but in very significant parts. At the same time, the new gurus, many of them, as we now know from past history, assumed more of a profile than they could handle. And so you had those two things developing. You had more emphasis on the collection of money at the expense of book. And then you had gurus who were becoming too more powerful than they could spiritually be
sustained.
So then it went through to about 85. Then we began to see certain things start collapsing. Then the gurus started losing their. It became obvious that they couldn't handle large numbers of disciples. And that, combined with the book distribution, caused a big manpower drain, because the disciples lost their enthusiasm, and many left the movement, and many just sort of lost their enthusiasm. So it's definitely a combination of those two things that caused things to cause an attrition. And I think that's probably reached its peak about maybe a year and a half ago, or reached a low point, you might say. Of course, congregations were still growing. That part was always growing. And most temples were maintaining their programs. And it's probably going to be another year, I would say maybe 2 years, till it's what you could call a full recovery, in the sense of temples filling back up with devotees and book distribution being, you know, back on the mark again. I mean, till book distribution gets back to where it was, that might take 4 or 5 years till it gets up to that level of distribution. And more people are taking initiation now. So that whole... And there's a fear of devotees to become initiated because they know so many gurus fell. So they're very cautious about getting initiated. They want to be very sure they don't want it to happen to them. So that slowed the process of initiation in many, many temples there. So that's a definite slowing factor. But now gradually they're starting to take initiation. And more people are initiating than before. So it's going to take some time. But I think the worst part is over, and it's on the way up again now. Definitely on the way up. Many committed people have remained throughout all this, and they're kind of inspiring the others. But we've seen a definite historical phenomenon occur there. Of course, the we can understand that the movement is resilient in the sense that it's a spiritual movement. And if entities like Japan and Germany after the war have become so powerful simply for material reasons, we can understand that Krishna consciousness is also going to come back from its weak point because it's got Krishna behind it. So the mood is in America is positive now. Everyone more or less realized what I've said, that we've kind of passed through the worst part. It's still difficult. You know, there's still a lot of financial attrition due to that. You know, to make the transition from going from one economic base to another is difficult and takes time. But it's worth working for because we can all understand that it's still the most influential country. So the devotees there, they have that enthusiasm, as Prabhupada always said, that America leads the world. And we know that's true. I was just at what they call National Right to Life. It's an anti-abortion national convention in Washington, D.C. And it came out that when these interpretations of the law in 1973 came out, that more or less sanctioned abortion, that one by one laws were passed in other countries, England, Germany, I don't know about Germany, but Israel, Greece, many other Canada countries, just because America did, everyone just did it, followed it. So we probably said if America has become Christian conscious, the whole world follows. So that's why it's still there. You feel there's a lot of potential there.
Russia's coming in, but it's on
now. Yeah. In Calcutta, the Soviet Vice Consul was a Russian, and the Chief Consul's wife participated in the Rath Yatra. They're both Russians, and the Bengali communists objected because it's very communistic there.
Right.
It's because this was their policy, that they're now, the Hare Krishna religion is a bona fide religion. Their foreign policy reflects that, because they're very organized in their foreign policy.
Right.
Well, that was quite an amazing thing, really.
Swept
the street. In front of the wife of the chief counsel was on a chariot, and they just got completely into it.
Excuse me.
Okay. So we'll probably go right after.
You can stay for breakfast,
Yeah, and I think we'll just go right after that.